offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Welcome, dear listeners, to this week's episode of Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam. This is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Hari, and we are here to continue our discussion on the 1991 summer course series. This is the 12th discourse which Swami gave as part of that series. And this was the discourse which Swami delivered on the 1st of June. We are somewhere midway in that discourse. We've played about 4 clips and we'll continue there. But before that, a short summary of what Swami has said so far. And even before that, let me invite Hari to join all of us. Saram Hari.
Saram Prem.
And as we've been going through this discourse, it's about the essence of sadhana, what sadhana is meant to do to us. In many ways, I think, of course, Swami is talking about how the transformation must happen, and Swami was talking about how you maintain a state which you have attained through sadhana, and also to ensure that constant progress. That is what sadhana is meant for. But more or less, the other aspect which Swami speaks of, especially when Swami is talking about sorrow and pain, it is almost like a corrective procedure of your perspective. That's what sadhana does to you. It allows you to see things as they are meant to be seen. Because the padyam with which Swami started, he said that you learn a lot, you study a lot, you have a lot of achievements to your credit, but you do not have humility. So Swami was saying that the devotion to the Lord, which is also another form of sadhana, is what gives you that humility. And I think that humility comes when you can put your achievements and your learnings in perspective, when you're not allowing that to get to your head in that sense. So in a way, I think you can also say that sadhana is a way by which you correct the way you look at the world, the way you look at money, fame, knowledge and all of that.
Because sometimes what I was also thinking is that these aspects like money, fame, achievement, etc., they become like a mask which you can wear, you know, and also becomes your safe space. Whenever you see that things around you are actually not working, like say your, like how you relate to people at home, or in general, like even if you are not finding peace yourself, finally what we say is, no, but I have done this, or I have achieved so much, I have got so much money, so it must be, you know, something. I must be doing something right. And plus, or, you know, it is a price that I've had to pay in order to get there. Right. So that I may lose my peace of mind, or I may not have good relationships at home. But then that is how it's supposed to be in, if you have to achieve these things.
Right.
So those are some of the masks we wear, you know.
One thing which is, which keeps coming every time you talk about, especially sadhana, and I think when Swami speaks about this in earlier discourses also, very honest look at yourself is very important. You know, sometimes you could be doing some things which is probably prescribed in the spiritual texts, but you might be not having peace of mind. That ability to say that, no, this is not working for me, even when, you know, people might be looking at you, oh, he is a regular for Nagar Sankirtan, oh, I see him every day in the mandir, oh, I see him very calm. We sometimes even get carried away by that kind of a thing. You know, that's, I think, more dangerous. Where everybody around you thinks that you are spiritual, and if you are not calm and settled inside, right, and you try to go along with the image that people have with you, that way of looking at yourself and being absolutely honest, and saying that, no, there is something lacking, and that I think is very, very important in many senses.
Yeah, you have to be like in a very straight conversation with yourself. Like,
right.
All while the world, yeah, because for world, for whatever their reasons, they'll keep praising you for this or for that, you know, saying, as you said, like your spiritual attainment. And I think lot of spiritual gurus do fall into that trap, you know, every now and then, because there is a certain happiness in appreciation, right, and undeniable. And also useful in its own sense. But at the same time, to completely fall for that, you know, that is something which Swami keeps warning us against.
In fact, yesterday's, I'm sorry, complete your...
Yeah, I'm done.
Yesterday's Science Pious, in that Swami says that very beautiful point about Narada, who is not having peace of mind.
Yeah.
So he's roaming around and he's very disturbed and he comes across sage Sanat Kumara, and the sage asks him, what are you disturbed about? And so the sage asks him, what are your achievements? What have you gathered? So he says, I've learned all these arts, I've mastered music, I've studied all the scriptures and all that. So then the sage says that all that is fine, but have you made the attempts to know yourself? I mean, the way Swami puts it, it's about sage Narada, whom we all revere and respect. And even he, Swami says that even the act of constantly being in the thoughts of the Lord and being admired and adored by everybody will not give you peace of mind unless you embark on this journey of trying to unravel yourself.
Yeah.
In a way of being very honest to yourself and literally tearing yourself apart and saying that this is what I really am. Unless we start doing that, we are not on that journey towards peace of mind.
Because Swami's constant exhortation to students, to devotees, many discourses, he distinguishes between what being good and being great.
Right.
And Swami would say always the aspiration is should be towards being good.
Mm-hmm.
And greatness may or may not accrue to you, but then being good for Swami was so very important. So he would stress a lot on that, which is what, you know, like in a sense that what we lose sometimes in the aspiration for greatness is things like this, you know, like peace of mind and maybe peace of mind of others who are around us. So Swami would say keep track of that. And when you have goodness with you, definitely you will have that happiness, that that peace of mind, equilibrium. So those are the things Swami would say that you need to aspire for.
Right.
Mm.
And Swami was talking, of course, as I said, about the three-pronged approach which sadhana provides.
Yeah.
One is transformation. And when Swami spoke about transformation, he always said it is from sadness to joy, from evil to good. Mm. That is the transformation which has to happen. And Swami was saying constantly, just like how even if you want to you know, maintain the brilliance of an object, a simple object, you need to keep polishing it over a period of time. And that is also a form of sadhana. Yeah, I recall, I think we must have quoted this any number of times, the conversation which Swami had with Professor Anil Kumar, where he asked Swami, what is sadhana? And Swami gave the description of the APSRTC bus driving through a kacha road, you know, or a mud road. Swami was saying that when the bus is traveling in a road such as that in the villages, you'd always see this dust storm behind the road, you know, because the bus is kicking up all that dust. So Swami was saying that the dust will always be behind the bus, but it will not be around the bus as long as the bus is moving. The moment the bus stops, you would find that cloud of dust engulfing the bus. So Swami said it's the same thing. As long as the sadhaka is constantly doing sadhana, Maya will be at his heels, but it will not be able to engulf him. The moment you stop, it's right behind you to, you know, come over you. And it's a very beautiful example of Swami has given. So Swami is saying that, you know, sadhana cannot be, I mean, that's a very important point. I think even the morning program I was making a mention of this. That many times that first experience which we have, especially of kind of an awakening, you know, we've been living a certain kind of lifestyle. We come to Swami, we are so moved, and there is a change, there is a shift which happens within us. We tend to get too carried away by that moment and think that that will last forever. But to maintain that, actually you need to get into some form of sadhana. You might or might not have similar awakening moments to follow, but you need to keep, you know, at it so that at least that what you've already found is retained.
Yeah. I think the second point also is very important, that the fact that such awakenings may, you know, actually what comes along with that awakening is some kind of euphoria. You know, life is now totally different. And it's human nature to want to hold on to that euphoria also, or hope for that euphoria to happen again, which may not happen, which is why so many people keep asking that question, like, I have done all this sadhana, but I don't see any spiritual progress happening. Whereas in fact, what you're doing is perhaps you're retaining that memory of that old, you know, that euphoria or that first time when it happened and you want it to happen again, right? But that is something, as Swami would say, you know, lot of the things that we see when they happen, like a fruit, a flower blossoming, there's a lot of processes that have taken place long before that happens. Maybe you see it, you know, you're lucky enough to see that flower bloom in front of your eyes. But then, that's a very rare event. So, a lot of things have to take place before this happens.
And I think even in the worldly sense, many times we have this experience. You know, we experience something for the first time. Generally, they say if you go for something like an opera for the first time and you go, it's a very different experience. But you have the memory of that experience, but you never actually hit the same experience when you go to the, you know, go through the same process again.
Mm.
Because one thing is that experience itself was powerful, and you've built a, you know, a kind of idea about it after the experience. Oh, this was very, very beautiful, and you know, it can never be replicated.
That anticipation.
Right, that anticipation and that whole thrill of going through that thing. And of course, after that, Swami was speaking about how, why education and knowledge and even virtue, all of that should not lead to any kind of pride, because all of this is gathered on the way. I mean, even something like cultured behavior, you have a decorum which has been inculcated into you.
Mm.
So Swami is saying that anything which is gathered along life, like knowledge or talent or any of these things, is something which can come and go. So don't take too much pride, be too very proud about that.
Mm.
I think Swami is telling that in two senses. One is, it is sadhana which actually gives you, you know, even in music, what we call riyaz in Hindustani. In South, in Karnataka, it's called sadhana.
Mm.
When you do practice of music, it's called sadhana. So any form of refining a talent which you have is actually called sadhana. So Swami is saying that sadhana will give you a certain elevated state, but don't get too attached to that, because it's not your real state. It has been gathered over a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So just like knowledge cannot be held as your own and be proud of, even the benefit you get through sadhana, actually you have to be a little detached from that. I think it's a very beautiful and subtle point that Swami is making there. And Swami was then talking about effort, where anything of worth comes only through effort. And he was equating that effort and that difficulty or challenge to sorrows. And he says that if you do not embrace that challenge wholeheartedly, you will not get the fruit which is on the other side of that. So he was referring to that kashte pali, which Swami would often quote. And I think last week the clip which we played was about life expectancy. As Swami would, you know, Swami was talking about shatamanam bhavati satyuha, where that's how people bless, but merely by blessing you don't get a 100-year long life.
And what cuts away at
right,
that?
What cuts away at that?
And Swami was very categorical. Pride, envy, and immorality. He spelt out that these three are the knives that slice away at life. And really, like Swami in earlier discourses also, he mentioned that how actually all of these lead to so much agitation in the mind.
Right.
You know, it's very nice to that initial, that indulgence, you know, just imagine, like, we've often seen people like that, no? Like, say they are in very, elevated positions in society, or they enjoy, like, temporary fame, and that time they are in the limelight, and we all admire them and all that, but the moment they fall out of it, right, or even while they're at it, as they say, uneasy lies the head that dons the crown.
Right.
It's always, you know, that is the kind of, almost a reality of these, like when you talk about pride, envy, and immorality, the moment they do come, we enjoy that feeling for a while, say pride, right, that for that temporary moment, you know, we can say look down upon people or hold our noses high, but then what happens after that, like, are we ready for that fall? As they say, pride always goeth before a fall. So we're not prepared for that. And those are the consequences. So, and when that happens, there's absolutely no one to hold you when you fall also.
I recall once seeing a drama which was a depiction of a king. I don't recall any details of that, but there's a very beautiful scene in that. You know, here is this king who is the ruler of the realm, but he would every day eat his food from earthen vessels, like how the farmers and the, you know, workers in his kingdom would eat. And one day the ministers will dine with him, you know, on one special occasion they will dine, and they will be surprised to see this. The king, who is having all the riches, is actually eating from a very humble vessel, and he's eating some, that sort of a food which the peasants would eat. So when they ask him, you know, why do you eat this? So then he says, see, I am a king today, but my primary role is to protect my people. So if tomorrow I need to go on a war, I will be stripped of all my wealth and I'll have to come to this state. So to be mentally prepared for this, Because when there is a need, I should not think that, oh, if I go for a war, I'll lose all my wealth. So that should not ever stop me from going forward to protect my people. Mm-hmm. So I mentally prepare myself by willfully embracing some of these, poorer conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So that when my call for duty comes, I'm ready to go forward.
Right.
So I think that's a very important thing. People might say it's a very negative approach, that you're talking about a downfall during your, high.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so important to be prepared for, the high as well as the low.
Yeah. And also one more, as you were saying this, I was also thinking, like, what kind of person would do that? It's always important to note also the internal state of such a person.
Mm-hmm.
And as you, like, when you mentioned that, he has all the riches around him and he's eschewing all that and choosing to eat through earthen plates, right? So the person who can do that is a person who no longer has that need or a desire of enjoying that luxury, and which is why he can now go beyond that and say that and look at what is needed to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Said in another way, his focus has now shifted from satisfying his own desires or satisfying what his mind's cravings are to look at the larger thing of what his duty calls on him to do.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I think that's a very important link, that we speak of what is called enlightened leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And we do see, people do occupy positions, all kinds of people occupy positions of leadership. But we can see that the people who are sitting in such positions and who use it to satisfy their personal cravings, like the need for admiration or the need for, people to, for fame, of that feeling of power, when they make it all about themselves, that I'm in this seat and I need these things to happen, I want this, I want that, we can see that such people, they suck the energies out of the people around them, right?
Right.
And the ideal people, or it's not an ideal thing, we've seen there are such amazing leaders who sit there in such positions and they're not seeking anything for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Their eyes always on the larger picture called, like, okay, I am in this, how can I contribute to society?
Right.
Like, for me, a very beautiful example is the past president of the United States of America, Barack Obama.
I was thinking of a different president. Okay, complete yours.
Yeah. Like, if you read his biography, you can always see what stood out for me is this, that he was always engaged in the service of society.
Mm-hmm.
It started out by serving the black community, looking at where their rights were not being protected, etc. And at some point he realized that his contribution can be far, far greater if he chooses to run in politics.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that was the reason, he's not looking for any personal benefit out of that, which is what made him stand out, as a person for the people, doing things for the people. And you could see the difference between a very distinctive style of leadership as opposed to the others.
Yeah, I was actually thinking of President Kalam. Was another person who stands out as that. And there was this very beautiful incident someone was narrating. Again, details always slip my mind. It's about a guest who calls on him the day before he is going to remit office. Right? It's his last day. One of his longtime friends comes to meet him, and he hosts him at the Rashtrapati Bhavan. And this friend of Kalam asks him, "So how do you feel? You're going to leave this luxurious life and you're going to go back to where you started off, some time back." So Abdul Kalam very casually tells him that, "Why don't you join me? Because there is much of this place I have not seen myself. So before I leave, let's together see the whole place." Says, and they go around. I mean, that's how simple a man he was. And I mean, that integrity, as you're saying, it does not come from just goodness, but it comes from a nobility. I mean, that's the best way I can put it. From that nature of being able to sacrifice, being absolutely upfront when it comes to duty. Because I think that is the difference between goodness and nobility. A good person may do all the right things and may keep out of trouble for himself and for others. But a person who is noble is the one who is constantly thinking what is the right thing to do at that time.
Mm.
And that might be even taking tough decisions which may apparently hurt others. But I think that's where the line between, you know, goodness and nobility comes, where a person is good but also constantly asking what is the thing I need to do at this
right
point in time.
Right? Yeah.
Then Swami was talking in this discourse about ego and how that is one of the veils which stops you from understanding what you need to understand. Swami was talking about self-confidence, but immediately followed it up with ego. How ego veils one's sight, and ego must be renounced. He was saying that, referring back to all the achievements, he's saying degrees, riches, fame and power are like passing clouds. And I think we were making that mention about passing clouds being a very beautiful way to depict these things.
Yeah.
Because clouds don't have any amount of volume in them.
Fluff.
Even if you were to fly through them, you find that there is nothing in it actually.
Yeah.
And literally all of this is like that.
And Swami there makes this connection. I think as we were speaking about this, Swami says that people dedicate half their lives to the accumulation of money. Do they even use a fraction of their time in spiritual pursuits? And there Swami makes this declaration, for what has this body been given to them? And that is a fundamental thing we need to inquire. You know, Swami is giving the answer even, but that answer, paropakarartham idam shariram, it has to be something that we'll have to, it's non-intuitive again. Right? We are not designed to think, nor does society itself support that view. Right, it'll have to go beyond, you know, what we take for granted as the definition of what this body is meant to do. Tell me, in which school would, you know, which academic institution would you find the teachers orienting them in that direction and saying, like, look not for your benefit, or look not what, as Kennedy would say, you know, like, it's not about what the country can do for you. Look for what you can do for the country. Much the same way. Like, so Swami has very clearly stated, paropakarartham idam shariram. And that is the, I think, the key point. That all the time, where is our attention dedicated to? The dedication is always towards what we can accumulate for ourselves.
Right.
And Swami is saying, no, that focus has to shift to what you can do for the society.
Right. And Swami would often say that this is the, it's a sensitization which Swami would always do. Because, you know, going back to what you were telling about the university, which other university would teach this, you know, because Swami would say that, you know, you are being given education. And we always would equate giving education to empowering someone. So you're being empowered with something which is so powerful, education, which really can help you find your way in society. But you're being sensitized that it has been given to you for this purpose, because the use for the body is when it is used for others. And this education will help you in that. You know, literally saying that it's not for grabbing for yourself, but it is to serve this purpose of paropakarartham idam shariram.
Correct.
As what we were discussing just before the program started, Swami would often encourage students to take up, you know, entrepreneurial roles where they can provide some form of employment to people and would be in a position where they can run very ethical organizations, which Swami would very often, I think in some of the discourses Swami has made this mention when he speaks to the MBA students, that he would be happy if students were to take up this leadership role in this form.
Yes, and quite a few have indeed, though the numbers can definitely be far greater. But whatever we have seen, you know, like, that is sometimes bring tears to my eyes, because they go all out, in following Swami's words to the letter, like down to the amount of self-sacrifice. Like, we were speaking several times we have had, some of our alumni on in programs, I think, especially the ones with Bishu hosts.
Right. Like Mr. Gunaranjan.
Mr. Gunaranjan, we've had, and several others. Like, I can remember one of my juniors from IIT Chennai. So he was very keen that he should become a student here in Swami's institute, and he had such academic, you know, achievements to his credit. Like, he was the gold medalist in his branch in IIT Chennai. And for such people, universities abroad would roll out a red carpet, you know, it would be like with complete aid, anything which they wished, down to the airfare, you know, all that would be given. And but his mind was so focused on Swami. Like every of his vacations, he would come here because I was already working here. He would come and ask me, you know, what is life like and what is Swami like. He had so many questions about Bhagwan. Finally, he ended up like being a student over here. And at the completion of his studies, what he wanted to do most was that he wanted to serve the society as Swami had, you know, directed in several. He no longer wanted anything for himself. And as you know, like Vinod Karthik, he then went on to create, you know, the Sai Krishna, that or charitable trust for. He runs an orphanage in the outskirts of Bangalore. Just to see, you know, these are all examples of people who completely, you know, sacrificed whatever their personal ambitions, everything, because for them it was so very important to follow Swami's word. And Gunaranjan, to take his example, extraordinary individual, right, down to, if people never be able to believe, you know, that while he has dedicated his life definitely to service of society through starting a philanthropy exchange and so much activities in the realm of healthcare, but for me it's not his, the service activities by themselves are of course something very commendable. But what is more inspiring is the person who is doing it.
Right.
The way that example which he sets, like, I know that he comes from a very affluent family. Okay. Yet he has made the choice that when I am serving people, I cannot myself, you know, lead an affluent life. So he owns two pairs of clothes. And then he even to this day, you know, he lives like a Sai student. That is, he, in his office premises, there's one small little room, just a few feet area that he set aside for himself, where he sleeps during the night with a mattress and everything which is laid out on the floor, just like our hostel dormitory rooms, right? Same. And as Swami said so many times, you know, about food. So, such control on food, he eats maybe once or twice a day, very little quantity, just enough for his activities. So, these are examples, they're inspiring for this reason. Like, they look human like the rest of us, right? In the sense that, so, they have a body, they seem to have the same aspirations as each one of us do. But what kind of aspirations? They aspire not for themselves, but for something far, far, far greater. For the upliftment of humanity, you know, for the upliftment of the needy. And that is extraordinary. And to see, you know, like, that these are people who would have traveled the normal track, you know, or would have jumped into the rat race like anyone else. But they chose to strike a path of their own and still remain unsung, you know, not seek credit. That is extraordinary. I think we can see Bhagwan's glory reflected at least in some small measure through people like this.
Absolutely. Well, I think we'll go to the next clip, because I mean, there's nothing more to add after what you've spoken, Hari. We'll go to the next clip, the fifth clip in that discourse, and we'll discuss what Swami has to say there.
అర్థములేని స్వార్థాన్ని ఆధారం చేసుకుని అనంతమైనటువంటి ఆత్మతత్వాన్ని విస్మరిస్తున్నాడు.
Making this meaningless selfishness as the basis, he is forgetting the infinite atmic principle.
కనుక మానవుడు మొట్టమొదట తన యొక్క స్వార్థాన్ని దూరం చేసుకున్నప్పుడే ఈ దుష్క్రియల లోపల ఏమాత్రం కూడా ప్రవేశించడానికి అవకాశం ఉండదు.
Therefore, first and foremost, when man gives up selfishness, there would be no scope for venturing into bad actions. Fear of sin is gone. What is primary for man? Fear of sin, love for God, and morality in society. We must consider these three as the Trinity.
పాప భీతి లేనప్పుడు ఎలాంటిదైనా కూడా మానవుడు ఆచరించడానికి నడుము కట్టుకుంటాడు.
When there is no fear of sin, man will be prepared to do any sort of action.
పాప భీతి లేని పామరత్వము బట్టి దైవ ప్రీతి లేని దాని బట్టి మానవత్వం అనగే మానవులందున విశ్వశాంతికి ఏ విప్లవము.
Due to the foolishness of having no fear of sin and because of no love for God, humanness has deteriorated in humans. These are detrimental to world peace.
ఈ విశ్వశాంతికి విప్లవం ఇదే. ఏమిటి? పాపభీతి లేకపోవటము, దైవ ప్రీతి లేకపోవటము, ఈ రెండింటి యొక్క కారణం చేతనే ఈ దేశం విప్లవానికి గురి అయిపోయింది.
Absence of fear of sin and absence of love of God, these two are the causes for disturbances in world peace.
Vidyarthulara,
students,
bhavi bharatodharakulu,
the future of Bharat,
bhavishyaka jeevithulaku meere deeniki aadharam,
you are the foundation for the future life.
Kalaka parishuddhamaina chittamu kaligi,
so with a pure heart,
pavitramaina bhavamula cheta,
with sacred feelings,
deshopakara nimittamai ఈ దేశం ఆవిర్భవించినదనే సత్యాన్ని గుర్తించి కనుక తోటి మానవులకు సరి అయిన చేదోడు వాదోడుగా ఉండి,
అండర్స్టాండ్ ద ట్రూత్ దట్ దిస్ బాడీ ఈస్ గివెన్ టు సర్వ్ ద నేషన్ అండ్ బీ హెల్ప్ఫుల్ టు యువర్ ఫెలో మ్యాన్,
లోకస్థ సుఖినోభవంతు అనేటువంటి విశాల భావాన్ని పెంచుకోవాలని నేను ఆశిస్తున్నాను.
ఐ హోప్ దట్ యు కల్టివేట్ సచ్ ఎక్స్పాన్సివ్ హార్ట్ దట్ ప్రే ఫర్ ద హ్యాపీనెస్ ఆఫ్ ద హోల్ వరల్డ్.
వ్యాస మహర్షి అష్టాదశ పురాణములు రచించాడు.
The great sage Vyasa composed the 18 Puranas or scriptures.
కాని ఏమిటి దాని యొక్క అంతరార్థము? అష్టాదశ పురాణేషు వ్యాసస్య వచన ద్వయం, పరోపకార పుణ్యాయ పాపాయ పరిపీడనం, హెల్ప్ ఎవర్ హర్ట్ నెవర్.
బట్ వాట్ ఈస్ దేర్ ఎసెన్స్? ది 18 పురాణాస్ ఆఫ్ వ్యాస టీచ్ టూ ఇన్స్ట్రక్షన్స్, టు హెల్ప్ అదర్స్ ఇస్ మెరిట్, టు హార్మ్ అదర్స్ ఇస్ సిన్. Help ever, hurt never.
ఈ రెండింటిని మీరు చిత్తమునందు భద్రం చేసుకోండి.
Keep safe these two thoughts in your heart.
ఎలాంటి పరిస్థితి ఎందైనా కూడా ఎవరిని బాధించకుండా చూసుకోండి.
Whatever be the circumstances, ensure not to hurt anyone.
సాధ్యమైనంత వరకు కూడా నీవు కూడా నువ్వు బాధపడకుండా కూడా చూసుకోవాలి.
Try as much as you can not to get hurt yourself too.
సెల్ఫ్ లో భద్రం ఉంటే కదా హెల్ప్ లో పవిత్రమైనది ఆచరించవచ్చు.
Only when the self is safe, help can be rendered in a sacred way.
Kanuka self to help swartham parartham rendittu yokka yadarthanni gurtinchadani prayatninchali.
So make efforts to understand the significance of both self and help, selfishness and selflessness.
Vidyarthulara,
students,
inadi manava jeevithamu aneka samasyalato kattubadi untundali.
Human life today is entangled with many a troubles.
కేవలం సమస్యల తోరణంగానే తయారవుతుండాలి.
It is in fact becoming a festoon of troubles.
దేనిని నమ్మాలి, దేనిని నమ్మరాదు, దేనిని చేయాలి, దేనిని చేయరాదు అనేటువంటి యొక్క నిత్యాధిక్య విషయ పరిశీలన చేసేటువంటి యొక్క శక్తి సామర్థ్యం ఈనాడు మానవుడు కోల్పోయినాడు.
What to believe in and what not to, what to do and what not to do. Man today has lost the power and ability to perform such eternal ephemeral based discrimination.
నమ్మరాని వాటిని నమ్ముతున్నాడు.
He believes in what he is not supposed to believe in.
నమ్మదగినదాన్ని నమ్మటం లేదు.
And not believing what has to be believed.
దీనికి కారణం ఏమిటి?
What is the reason for this?
దీనికి కూడా స్వార్థమే.
Selfishness is the reason for this too.
మనస్సు యొక్క తత్వాన్ని చక్కగా మనం గుర్తించడానికి ప్రయత్నించాలి.
We must try to precisely understand the nature of the mind.
మానవుడే జగత్తును సృష్టిస్తున్నాడు.
Man creates this world.
మనిషి అంటే ఎవరు?
Who is a manishi or human being?
మనిషి అంటే మనసే.
Manishi is the mind.
మనసు అంటే ఏమిటి? సంకల్పముల యొక్క చేరిక.
What is the mind? It is a bundle of thoughts.
సంకల్పములు అంటే ఏమిటి?
What are thoughts?
నిత్య జీవితంలో మనం ఆచరించడానికి ప్రవేశపెట్టేటువంటి చర్యలే.
దే ఆర్ ది యాక్షన్స్ విచ్ వీ పుట్ ఇన్ టు ప్రాక్టీస్ ఇన్ డే టు డే లైఫ్.
కనుక ఈనాడు జగత్తంతా కూడా నువ్వు చర్యలు బాగుండినప్పుడే జగత్తు బాగుంటుంది.
సో టుడే వెన్ ఆర్ యాక్షన్స్ ఆర్ గుడ్ ద వరల్డ్ విల్ బి గుడ్.
చర్యలు చెడిపోయినప్పుడే జగత్తు కూడా నువ్వు చెడిపోతుంది.
వెన్ ది యాక్షన్స్ గో రాంగ్ ద వరల్డ్ గెట్స్ రూయిన్డ్ టూ.
కాబట్టి జగత్తు యొక్క మంచి చెడ్డలంతా కూడా నువ్వు వ్యక్తుల యొక్క చర్యల పైన ఆధారపడి ఉంటుండాలి.
So the good and bad of the world depend upon the actions of the individuals. World is never bad. Evil just does not exist in this world. There is no sorrow in this world. It is we who create evil and sorrow. Because of the bad desires, we fall prey to sorrow. So always keep your mind pure. Ensure that no ill feelings whatsoever enter the mind. When anything bad enters it, that very moment, contemplate on God and get rid of that evil. You should not instead protect the thorny bush that has grown, nurture it and help it flourish.
So that was the next clip in that discourse, and for those of you listening to it first time, it's been retranslated. The voice of the translator that you heard was Brother Sunil of Radio Sai. Well, continuing in that, Swami ended the clip that we played last week by saying, you know, how we literally become puppets in the hands of selfishness. It's very interesting, you know, because Swami starts off by talking about education and talent and all of that. I mean, and all that we do through life is to enhance all that what we've got, you know, in the form of our talent or in the form of our learning. We are enhancing all of that. But if all of this is under the trap of this selfishness, it is being literally the strings of these, all these achievements which we have is pulled by selfishness, I mean, that's going to be really ruinous. That's what Swami is saying, that first and foremost, you need to change the order of things, where you should have selflessness guiding all of your talents.
Mm-hmm.
That's the order in which Swami is talking about, because Swami speaks about paropakaratam idam shariram, and saying that once you get that right, then all of your talents can be put to the ideal use.
Right. Right.
And Swami again goes back to this, the three statements which we've heard from Swami many, many times. Papa Bhiti, Deva Preeti and Sanganiti. And again, it comes to that foundation being love for God. When love for God is the foundation, then everything else falls in place.
Right.
You know, because we find that somebody was giving a beautiful description about Duryodhana in Mahabharata, where Duryodhana is always a character which you, in many places you will see that he follows the Sanganiti very well. Mm. Where, you know, if you look at him, he appears like he's doing the right thing all the time.
Mm.
But you know that there's something wrong.
Right.
So it is like ensuring that your actions are legal, but they may not be ethical.
Correct. Legally, they're pretty much justifiable.
Right.
But then, at the end of it, like, yeah, as you said, does it have the sanction of this, of spirituality?
Right.
And like, is this the right thing to go by that? Yeah. And I've always felt, you know, like, for this, one thing that we need to do is to actually, as Swami says, right, that learning should ultimately result in humility.
Right.
Because the process of learning actually calls for humility. The moment we arrive at a place called I know, and that is the end of learning itself. And so we need to clear the cache, you know, as we use in computer, that terminology. Right? We need to clear the cache of what we think is true.
Mm.
Right? Because the moment we hold on to that, then what happens is, like, we are then able to justify every action of ours, you know. So, as you are speaking about Duryodhana, I was also thinking about Karna.
Right.
Right. So, if you look at his actions, and the entire time, he lives in that bubble called I owe, you know, my everything to Duryodhana. And my friendship with Duryodhana is very important. And all his actions are based simply on that, because he's hooked to Duryodhana. Now, that thing, at the source, there is a problem, right? And it contaminates everything else, no matter what kind of action. Now, he might think in the deepest of his hearts that, you know, I am doing the most, you know, excellent thing, or as sanctioned by the scriptures. But at the source, it is wrong.
Mm.
because again Sanghaniti comes into play. Right. Right? The right, you need the right kind of society, the right kind of friendships, connections, right, in order for the other things to fall in place.
Right. And Swami makes this very beautiful statement before he came to that. He said, you know, making selfishness as the foundation, one forgets the infinite Atma.
Yeah.
It's a very beautiful statement because, you know, when it all comes from the definition of self, because, you know, Atma is also called self. And oftentimes, you know, I would think selfishness, why can't it be what Swami calls Atma Bhavam? You know, the moment the selfishness becomes that self of the capital S, as we usually say, it will automatically result in paropakaratam idam shariram, where you cannot consider your own, you know, benefits as more important than the benefits of others.
Right.
So that's where that shift happens, where, you know, the moment that selfishness is based on the true self, you'll automatically be seeing everybody as, you know, your own. And you cannot act in a manner which is beneficial only to yourself.
Correct. And that infinite Atma is the true nature. So what Swami is telling is, in fact, that selfishness is a form of sacrifice.
Right.
In the sense that you are holding on to something so small, whereas something much, much larger, which is just out of your pale of understanding, but otherwise it is available to you.
Right.
And you are holding on to this something very small. Also that, you know, when once selfishness makes it's established within us, then starts the others, you know, this fear of, that's why Swami says fear of sin is like so very important, and it's you know, quite something. It's very easy to become complacent in these matters, and so much so that we may not even understand, you know, that in which direction we are proceeding. Like there's this very famous philosopher called Hannah Arendt. You know, she's a Jewish lady, and she was a student of one of the greatest Western philosophers, Heidegger. And what had happened, you know, she was very curious about the being a Jew, you know, like how is it, what was in the mentality of the Nazis that that they became such monsters who would exterminate, you know, almost 6 million people from the planet. Like what was driving them to do that? And so she sits on the trial, in the trials of Adolf Eichmann, who was, you know, like the right-hand man of he was one of the generals in, and he was responsible for so many of the concentration camps and the infamous trains, you know, which would take the Jews to these concentration camps. And while sitting in that trial, she was observing that you're not looking at the face of evil, actually. You look at this person, he looks like such a, like a human being, like any one of us. And then when she's trying to parse, like, what are the, you know, the motivations for his actions? You don't see evil present even in that. All that person is going on saying is that I was following orders. I was doing what was good for the country. I was doing what the leader of the country was telling me to. And any good general is a person who takes orders from his leader as the command, right down to the T. Now you can imagine that it's all of his statements, you know, would lead you to believe that this is a person who's completely doing what is right, you know, by his own light. But that is what she was trying to point out. So she gives this whole thing, she calls it the banality of evil. That when you look at evil, it is not something that presents itself as a monster, right? It will look like, just like any one of us. And the person himself may be unaware. And that is the point that you have to catch. Which is why Swami says fear of sin. Because it is so very, very, very easy to be unaware that sin can creep in without you knowing.
I think that's why Swami would often say this, you know, in talking about dharma. Swami would say there are many paradharmas, right? You know, based on your situation in life. As a father, as a know, man of the house, as a commander in an army, or all of that. You know, these are situational dharmas which you have. But at any time, the Atma Dharma should be in a position to overrule these dharmas. Because that's what Swami would say, that, you know, whatever be the condition you were in, whatever be the person who is superior to you, giving you orders, you cannot discount the fact that each one of you have a conscience.
Right.
And the final sin is always disobedience to the conscience.
Mm.
You know, just like how insubordination is a big crime in the army.
Right.
You know, the final crime is that only, insubordination to the Atma. You don't follow the master and you face the music.
Yeah.
Not face the devil. But I think that's the important point. And Swami was talking about fear of sin. The other thing which Swami was talking here, I recall something which Swami mentioned in another discourse. He says, India is in such a situation full of agitation because there is no fear of sin and no love for God. Swami is mentioning that here. There was another discourse where Swami was telling that all of it comes because you have fear, but you don't have fear of sin.
Mm.
I think that was a very beautiful point. He said, man starts doing wrong things because he is insecure.
Yeah.
That fear of losing something, the fear of not being able to provide for the family, or the fear of losing your position, whatever it is, losing your promotion, or be what it may be, but some form of insecurity. But you don't have fear of sin, which is more important than that fear. And I think it was a discourse which Swami was giving to students. Swami said that one of the most important things that I want you all to do is to go and remove the fear from people. He says you have to remove the fear from people that, if you look at it, I think that's what Swami did for us. He removed very small insecurities which you can very easily tide over. And once that is removed, your morality automatically goes one notch higher,
right,
if not at the best place.
Yeah.
You automatically are, a statement which I always repeat here is, Swami constantly telling us, you after all have a stomach which is few inches long.
Mm.
I mean, reiterating that point, saying that you have enough talent to feed that stomach and even 5, 6 or 7 stomachs which are dependent on you. You don't need to stray from morality for that. I think that abhayam which Swami gives automatically gives you push towards morality.
Exactly. And I think the love for God is therefore that very essential ingredient in all of this.
Right.
Right? Because that love for God, then it does two things. I remember, you know, darshan time, one of the most important feelings that I would develop, you know, evening, you come after the day's proceedings and you come and sit for Swami's darshan. That very act of Swami, you know, walking in your midst, it was a kind of purging of the mind.
Mm.
Right? So the entire day, you have done so many actions and it has had consequences of all of its kinds. And at the root of it is certain misunderstandings in your own mind.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, no, that insecurity, which with the Anandavali also, as we pointed out several times, it talks about that insecurity is the starting point. The moment the person differentiates himself from the universal consciousness and begins to think of himself as an individual, the very first emotion that sets out is fear, that insecurity. And as you very beautifully, you know, connected it to the fact that we have that fear but not the fear of sin.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And those insecurities, those misunderstandings were what used to be removed the moment we looked at Swami.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somehow that feeling that no, everything is alright, for example. That itself is enough. You know, you look at Swami, such a placid smiling face. Right? That thing that yes, peace is possible. That the mind itself used to settle. And so you develop some kind of small annoyances, hatreds, whatever. Swami used to instantly purge that from the mind, just the sight of Bhagwan.
It's a two different levels when Swami speaks about Sangha Niti. We were talking about the difference between legality and morality.
Mm.
Sangha Niti is easily followed by most of us because to an extent we have the fear of law.
Yeah.
Right? But if we can do something wrong and remain undetected,
right,
then most of us would do that. I think a beautiful quote I read sometime back is, you really are what you are when you're absolutely sure that you're not going to be found out.
Okay.
Right? They say that that's what your true character is.
Yeah.
So this idea of Sangha Niti most of us would stick to.
Yeah.
And I think that's why Swami injects this idea of fear of sin. And whenever Swami speaks about sin, Swami would talk about this mythological character called Chitragupta.
Mm.
Right? The name itself is very beautiful. Chitragupta actually means the silent painter, in a sense. So he's sitting in your mind and silently noting down everything that you've done. So Swami would say that even when you're absolutely alone, be sure that it is being noted down.
Mm.
So he says that fear of sin will now bring you closer to morality.
Right.
From, you know, legality to probably morality or ethical living.
Yeah.
But even that is not good enough. Because this nature of this battle between the pleasure I can enjoy now and the problem I should face later.
Yeah.
Many of the time we you know choose the pleasure we can enjoy now.
Shreyas and
prayers. That fear of sin is not good enough to wane us away from choosing the happiness which we can have now.
Yeah.
And that's why that love for God becomes much, much more stronger incentive than any other thing can be. As you're saying, as many devotees would say, they're feeling that I have to come back and face Swami, I have to see Swami at his face.
That is the biggest.
That would take care of fear also. It's not only love.
Yeah. And actually, Sanganiti, there is another important, I think, component or dimension to that.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to what I was talking about, the banality of evil, which the philosopher Hannah Arendt, she pointed out. I think that baton was passed on to the existentialist writer Dostoevsky, Russian writer. And so he also examines the same concept of how does evil creep into a person.
Like, okay.
How does it establish itself? And one thing he recognizes is this, it's a kind of inability to examine like one's own thoughts, or sometimes the fact that there are lack of ideas itself, like ideas in the sense of like what is virtue, like what is vice, you know, those things are absent. And if you look at Shikshavali, the very towards the end, the verses which are chanted, you know, during just before the convocation, there it makes it very clear that when you are in doubt about what is right and what is wrong, you must consult elders who are well versed in dharma.
Okay.
It gives us that clear direction. That is why the Sanghaniti is also very important.
Right, right.
You know, how we speak about, you know, presently in a corporate setup, they always say that the CEOs must always have a mentor. Right, a person you can always check back with, or what, am I on the right path? Am I doing the right thing? You know, so in that sense, that Sanghaniti is very, very important. And so many times we are very fortunate. You know, I see that by Bhagwan's grace, you know, when I joined here as an MBA student, the kind of classmates that I had, they were people who used to foster that love of God in me. You know, from some of them I learned what is it that, you know, Bhagwan seeks out of students, out of their own personal interactions. You know, they would be so happy to share those things, you know, from the point of view of this is what Swami likes in a devotee or in a student, right? And I used to see that in their behavior too. So that used to reinforce, you know, and that's what keeps that fire alive of always being devoted to Bhagwan. That momentum is kept going because you have that, you're established in a structure that reinforces and supports that thing to which you are committed to.
Right. In fact, what you were saying about the inability to make those decisions, I think Swami speaks about that here. And then this paragraph where he says, the world is afflicted with many problems which seem only to worsen with time. What should be trusted and what should not be trusted?
Yeah.
What must you do and what must you not do? Such power of discrimination between right and wrong, between the temporary and the permanent, is beyond today's human being. I think it's a very important point. It's Swami is mentioning that, you know, with all our learning, you know, which comes from probably learning of the scriptures of what is dharma and what is adharma, even that in the mind level, that knowledge or that information in the mind level is not good enough sometimes to deal with the choices that we have to make in the life today.
Right.
I think that was something which we were speaking even in the morning satsang, where we say that the challenges which are thrown upon us are something which probably even sometimes the elders cannot guide us.
Yeah.
Because their generation has not seen the problems that, you know, we see in our generation.
Yeah.
So at some time, this turning towards the conscience has to happen.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the voice of the conscience may appear sometimes even irrational to the mind, but it has to be always adhered to.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the idea of Sanghaniti, which you spoke of, as good company comes in point of view. Where it's that good company which reiterates the voice of the conscience. It does not tell you anything new, but as Swami would say, that the voice of the conscience is always inside, but probably it's not loud enough for you to be able to decipher it sometimes.
Yeah.
So when you interact with somebody who is elder than you or who's more nobler than you, the idea is they reflect the voice of the conscience and they enable you to hear it better. And that's why you know, they say satsangatve nissangatvam.
Mm.
Satsanga is that which actually leads you to more towards solitude, where you can make those decisions on your own.
Right.
True satsanga is which that leads you to that, not that which makes you dependent on your friends and counselors.
That's right. And also the, like, very nicely Swami delineates, you know, the what is it that you must discriminate, you know, discriminate between right and wrong, and that's the first level, right? Between right and wrong. And Swami takes it to the next level, that what between the temporary and the permanent, which is of course the entire theme of the Upanishads itself is that, which is what is driving it, no? The whole time, we hold on to the temporary the whole time, right? Because whatever is fleeting, we want to hold on to that because that's what we like. And the permanent, unfortunately, is something that is beyond the ken of the mind.
Right.
It is something we cannot perceive. And hence, you know, to hold on to something that we cannot see, which is not tangible, and that requires faith.
Right.
And that is why, you know, that coming back to that love for God, and because that love for God is what will foster that faith. Otherwise, on what basis, you know, like I don't have any basis for saying that there is something better that awaits me when I can instead chase fame or money or something. Right? Where is the guarantee that that will provide the peace of mind that I was looking for? Right? And that comes out of that love for God.
Right.
And that love for God is something that has to be fostered, right? And for that, I need that support system called the society, which is actually, if you look at the very first chapter of Prema Vahini, Swami makes it very clear. It's almost the preface to the rest of the Vahini, is that it needs a society which starts believing in these as being more important. That Prema Vahini, the entire text, becomes relevant only in such a society. The moment we hold, you know, just like our education system, if it does not hold important that these are values by which a person needs to stand, then all of this becomes irrelevant. Till such time we, you know, realize the folly of it and again bring our attention and focus back to it.
In fact, Swami concludes that passage with that by saying that, you know, this decision making becomes difficult because of the fact that you're selfish, because of the fact that that selfishness clouds you. And as you beautifully said, one of the easiest ways to shed that selfishness is through love for God. Because the moment love for God, not all love for God can be equated to selfishness, but love for God automatically replaces the immediate benefit with something which is more noble. You know, at least it does that much. Again, there is a process within that too, where you go from being selfishly in love with God to becoming selflessly in love with God.
Yeah.
But any form of love with God automatically removes a bit of that selfishness, and it will automatically help you to make the decision between the permanent and the temporary.
I know we are just slightly beyond time, but Vishu, you know, a few days back he was telling me about one of his classmates, and Swami had suddenly begun to shower a lot of attention on him. So this classmate of his, he was always, you know, like always in trouble with the teachers, on the wrong side of the law, you know, so to speak. And so he had an interview with Bhagwan one morning, and soon after that he had to write a test. And he says, you know, like he comes to the test almost unprepared, and as any student would, you know, in that despair, he's looking around to look for somebody whom he can ask, you know, what can you guide me, what the answer is, like cheating, so to speak. And he says that, that the student was about to do it, and then suddenly he just stopped. And Bishu, you know, the student told Bishu later that at that moment it struck me that this is not something that Swami would expect me to do. It's such a simple thing, you know, like that love for God, it has us hold on to something. So it would have been very temporary. The marks would have come, you would have been out of trouble with parents and students and all. But that love for God is what had him apply the brakes at that moment to a very natural thing to do. I think that is very beautiful.
Very true. Yeah. Probably just to add to that, many of our listeners who are listening might think that, you know, as students you had the advantage of coming and sitting in front and looking at Swami, and you know, when I said that, the students would say that we have to finally face Swami. But the beauty is, many of those students, it was not even about being able to interact with Swami physically. It is just about saying that when I am sitting there, I need to be able to smile at Swami, whether Swami looks at me or not. Many of the students never had the opportunity to really interact with Swami. And now it is the case of when I am probably sitting in my prayer room, I am closing, I should love myself when I am sitting in front of Swami.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that is an attitude which is open to everybody. It is not related to proximity or nearness to Swami. I think that attitude defining your life is open to everybody, and in fact every devotee has to do that. There is no excuse for you and me and for anybody else. So I think we'll end with that. Thank you, dear listeners, for being with us. We most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. Do join us again at 7:30 next week for the continuation of this discourse. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his guests for the next and the final episode of today's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. We very gratefully offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet, and thank you all for your very patient listening.